This episode is sponsored by Paleo Valley's pasture-raised chicken sticks. I'm super excited to share Paleo Valley's brand new pasture-raised chicken sticks. These chicken sticks are made from 100% pasture-raised chicken and organic spices that are preserved using natural fermentation rather than preservatives. So yes, no fake stuff or additives here. These chicken sticks are sourced from regenerative family farms raised on American pastures, and each stick is free of chemicals, antibiotics, pesticides, and added hormones. Paleo Valley's chicken sticks are a perfect snack packed with 7 grams of protein and, frankly, a great value without skimping on quality. Make sure to support this podcast and head over to paleovalley.com/NWJ and use code NWJ to get 15% off your order. Thanks again for listening and supporting this podcast.
This is the time where you have to be extra cautious and paying attention and making all the changes and trying things. And if it doesn't work, you try something else. And if it doesn't work, you try something else, you know, but not giving up, because that is the time that you can do your most important job, which is to be a parent.
Hey guys, it's Judy from Nutrition with Judy. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Judy Cho and I'm board certified in holistic nutrition. And I have a private practice where we focus on root cause healing, and that often starts with the Carnivore Cures All Meat Elimination Diet. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Anna Fabrega. She is the new author of the book, The Learning Game. And in this conversation, we talk about all things learning, curiosity, challenging status quo, so that we can truly, ultimately live our best lives. We talk about the importance of why we need our children to think for themselves and to embrace challenge and even embrace quitting and what that means contextually. We talk about gamifying and allowing children to be curious about learning so that they can truly find their life's purpose or what they really want to double down in to be successful in life. We talk a lot about where our education system came from and why we even teach the way that we do, where we have one teacher in the front and how everything the teacher says is true and that all children should not speak until spoken to or raise their hand and not challenge the teacher. Otherwise, they're considered disruptive. We talk a lot about these things and then talk about what are solutions if we are part of the public school system and really can't get out of it, but how can we foster our children to think for themselves outside of the school system? And she gives really helpful tips that make sense. And in her book, she shares a lot of graphics and callouts that make a lot of sense. And here's one, for example. So you could see here, running to the rescue versus letting them struggle. And how it says, exposing kids to difficult situations will help them become more resilient, independent, and self-confident. In our conversation, I try to share several N=1 personal stories of how I struggle with that, where my gut instinct is to go and save my child, but how sometimes I know that's not for the benefit of them. We also talk about the medication epidemic that's going on with children with ADHD or ADD, and what we really think about that. Anna shares a little bit about her personal story, which she doesn't often share. And so I'm very grateful that she shared with us. At the very end, I get somewhat emotional with talking about this type of information. While it's controversial, I hope that you are open to some of the discussion that we are talking about. This conversation is filled with so many golden nuggets that I hope you take the time to learn, take some notes, and get her book, because it really talks through so many fundamental components that will help you be a successful parent in terms of helping your child learn and thrive in the future, as well as help you to really learn and think about what it really means to be outside of the box or challenge status quo and how that may really look like in real life. Let's get right into the conversation. Hi, Anna. It's so nice to finally meet you. I've followed some of your content for a while and I'm super excited to have you meet our community. For the people that are listening and watching that may not know you, if you can introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Judy. And likewise, I've been following you for a while and enjoy your content. So my name's Anna. I'm originally from Panama, but growing up, I moved around a lot. By the time I was 14, I had attended 10 different schools in 7 different countries. So when it comes to schooling, I like to say that I've been around the block a lot. And that sort of became the springboard for my desire to change a lot of the things that we do within the traditional school system. So after being a student myself of all these different placements, I decided to become a teacher. And that's when I started to notice a lot of the inconsistencies within the traditional school system and how it doesn't quite match the way that humans are designed to learn. And I didn't think that it was the best way to spend kids' time, which is, you know, the most important time of their lives, their childhood years. And I thought that there was a better way to do it. And so I left the traditional school system after teaching for 5 years. And since then, for the past 4 years, I've been exploring the alternative education space, which is making me feel very optimistic about the future of education. I joined a startup called Synthesis that's sort of at the edge of innovation. So it's nice to have sort of like I was on the other end of the spectrum, the very traditional school system, and then ended up here. And it's great to be able to explore a lot of the things that I think work and paving the way for what comes forward in the future of education. And a lot of my experience and the lessons that I've learned this past 4 years, and as a student myself and as a teacher, have kind of come together into my book, The Learning Game, that came out a few weeks ago. And so, yeah, I'm very excited to chat today.
Yeah, I love the book. It's, you have graphics and you have these call outs, like one that's right behind you. And I love that it's really easy to consume and understand that maybe the way that we're teaching our children, and even just the way that we learn and how it impacts us as we get older, may not be as ideal. And you talk about that there's 7 dangerous lessons that we learn when we're in school. So why does that matter even as an adult? Why do those lessons become dangerous as we are even older?
Yeah. So John Taylor Gatto, who was a very celebrated educator in the United States and who won, you know, Teacher of the Year 3 times in a row in New York City, he was sort of the one who talked about the 7 lessons. And it was the time that it opened my eyes to where we're stuck in the education system. And so when he won the award for 3rd time in the year, 3 years in a row, he wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal where, you know, people would expect for him to be thanking everyone and talking about how wonderful it is. But instead, he was announcing that he was quitting the profession. And he started writing about this, the reasons why he was quitting. And he highlighted 7 dangerous lessons that were teaching kids in the traditional school system that I happen to agree with. And so he talks about, for example, how one of the lessons that we teach is confusion. If you look at the curriculums that we're using and the order and the sequence of the topics that we are making kids memorize for all these tests and stuff, not only is the content not really relevant to a lot of the professions that we see today, but also just the sequence doesn't make sense. Kids learn about things like the hypotenuse, for example, but they don't really learn the practical application to it, or they don't really see how they can use it in the real world. And we know that knowledge decays really quickly. And if kids don't use what they know, kids and adults, by the way, what they're learning in the next 14 days, they forget about it. And so a lot of what's happening is that we're teaching things that lack context and practical application. And therefore, kids are just either memorizing to pass a test and then forget, or they just get confused and they don't really grasp the knowledge. And so we're wasting a lot of their time. Another lesson that John Taylor Gatto very eloquently put in the book was that we teach indifference. By ringing bells every 45 minutes and, you know, asking kids to learn about math, and then there's a bell and you have to close math. Even if they're interested or they want to keep going, after 45 minutes, they switch to science. After 45 minutes, they switch to literacy and so on and so forth. Well, first, we know that that's interrupting the learning process. Learning is interconnected. And the best way that we learn is when we're able to see how these different subjects fit within each other. So isolating topics by subject doesn't quite make sense. A way better way to learn is when you have a project or you have a problem and kids can actually see, again, the connection between the different themes and the different areas and the different subjects, they can interconnect that knowledge, and that's how knowledge sticks. And so, well, that, and also we need downtime to process a lot of these ideas and for knowledge to stick. And by interrupting kids every 45 minutes, when maybe they're just starting to get interested in the topic or in the lesson, or maybe they want to keep going, oftentimes it's not enough time to actually let that learning sink in. And so, you know, in addition to that, if you look at a kid's schedule, it's crammed with back-to-back things. And then they leave school and they have after-school activities that are, many of them are adult-led, and then they get home and they have homework. And so when do they have time to just be kids throughout the day, right? And to just relax and be bored by inactivity? That's where you get the creative breakthroughs, right? That's why you get so many ideas in the shower when you're not doing anything. Or when do they get time to just engage in free play and exploration, or to do the things that, you know, they want to do independently, not with an adult sort of telling them and directing them? And so he talks about how this turns into adults who, like, they're not really independent, right? They're used to somebody guiding everything for them and telling them what to do, telling them what to think, telling them how to do things, which sort of ties to the next one, which is in school, everything's sort of scripted and there's a lot of instructions and there's a right way to do things. And, you know, even if you get to the answer of a math problem in a certain way, oh no, the teacher wants to see the process, and the process better look like the process that she was teaching or he was teaching. And so it removes a lot of the creative aspects of learning. And it's very structured to the point where kids learn and turn into adults that expect somebody to always tell them what to do, what to think. And they don't really know what to do when there are no instructions. And the real world doesn't have instructions, doesn't come with instructions, right? Of course, there are jobs nowadays that require for you to do things a certain way and follow certain steps. But a lot of the jobs that these kids are looking up to nowadays are, you know, people who break from the pack, who do things differently, who, you know, kind of figure things out on their own. And it's a very important skill that we all need in this chaotic, uncertain world that keeps changing, right? Where change is the only constant. And then in addition to that, that's tied to the emotional and the academic dependency that we are, right? Like, kids in school depend on a teacher telling them how they're doing with, you know, stickers or red marks or report cards. And, you know, all their learning is based on these grades that then go in their report cards and sort of like stick with them for the rest of their lives. And what it's doing is a lot of the kids are scared of failure and are scared to go back and look at their mistakes and learn from them, right? Because they don't want to get penalized with that bad grade. And we've sort of created this negative connotation around learning by making it all about the grades and the assessments. And so as a result, a lot of adults, you know, these kids grow into adults that are risk averse, that don't know how to manage failure. And failure is something that we all face in different stages of our lives, and that we need a lot of practice in, you know, when the stakes are low, when you're young, right? When you don't know a lot of things and you're learning. So mistakes are part of that learning process. So schools just have a really messed up sort of attitude around that whole really important aspect of the learning process. And so, this whole idea of compliance as well. Like, schools teach you to adhere to authority and to do as you're told and not question, you know, when you're the teacher and there's a kid that's like, well, I don't agree with that. That's the kid that usually gets in trouble, right? Or that the teacher's like, oh, that's a troublemaker. Like, how is he defined? Like, you know, challenging me and challenging, when in reality, we need to teach kids to question everything in an appropriate way, right? And not necessarily believe everything that we tell them. And it's interesting because how many times have we seen things like, I cannot believe that we continue to teach the food pyramid, for example, in school. Like, how is that? Like, it's shocking to me. And we don't, you know, we just tell them, kids open the textbook and it's right there and we're teaching them about this. And it's like, they're just expected to blindly believe this. And as a result, half of the American population is obese, you know? So it's like, we're kind of teaching them that if everyone agrees with an idea, then it must be right. And you don't challenge that and you don't question that, when in reality, kids need to learn how to appropriately question everything and get to their own conclusions and see different points of view until they land into, you know, the truth. And so those are some of the lessons that we teach in school that I think we need to unlearn in order to be happier, more productive, and healthier adults.
Yeah. I mean, you touched on so many good points. During COVID, I saw a lot of that, just, I'm going to follow what is being told without questioning. And I'm being in a space in the wellness space that we're not following the food pyramid or my plate or even the recommendations for eating lots of carbohydrates. You start to question things beyond just the diet. So if I was wrong about the diet, that actually meat is good for me. I was plant-based for 12 years, for example, and it didn't do me that well. But you start to wonder, well, what else was I told wrong? And then I just saw some things during COVID that I didn't necessarily agree with. And I just saw people follow suit. And I just wondered, well, my oldest was going to join kindergarten for the first time. And then I saw some of the lessons because it was all online. Mm-hmm. And it just made me, ooh, I kind of don't like what they're teaching. Mm-hmm. And so we started looking for other schools. We tried to do homeschool. It didn't work for us well, but mm-hmm. they go to now the Socratic school where everything is questioned, everything, mm-hmm. whether it's a game, whether it's something they're learning, and it's up to them what they want to focus on. Mm-hmm. And I see the benefits because now fast forward a couple years, most adults that meet my children will say, your kids seem like adults and they are so well-spoken. And I just think they just are with kids that are different ages, but they get to talk to the guides and not think of them and address them as superior. The guides don't give them answers. And mm-hmm. I realize they are much more equipped to handle the real world, hopefully, because if everything that we are taught in this box is taken away from us, which kind of happened with COVID, well, what do you do now? And I feel like so many adults floundered once those rails were removed from us. Mm-hmm. And so I think your book is so important now and timely because we are forced to now look at, are we okay with being in this box that may go mm-hmm. away? And mm-hmm. if we aren't, then what options do we have now, especially for the next generation?
Yeah, Judy, what you shared is music to my ears. I absolutely love hearing that your kids are going to a Socratic school, especially because, you know, I totally believe what people say about your kids, even though I don't know them, because when you put kids in this kind of environment, it matches what we know about kids, about humans and how we learn and the kind of things that they need in order to develop both, you know, physically and mentally into adults, right? So, for example, this whole notion, you know, we continue to tell kids that and restrict their movement, right? By putting them into this very restrictive environment and telling them that they need to sit straight all day and no fidgeting, no bouncing, when, you know, we make them feel like this behaviors are wrong and we punish them for this when in reality, it's just an indication that they're not getting the movement that they need, right? We know if you look at the research, it shows that a kid needs to be moving around constantly. They need to be running around until they're exhausted. And that's when, you know, they can start actually learning. That's when they, you know, click in and that's what they need. And the opposite, like it's happening since kids enter kindergarten, it just becomes very, very, very restrictive. And then we start labeling, right? And that's when you start, oh, this kid has ADHD, they need medication. No, what they need is to be able to move and be in an environment that's more suitable to them. So those kinds of schools that you mentioned, like the Socratic environment, where not only can they ask questions, which is the way of that kids naturally try to think for themselves. When they ask questions, they're trying to think from first principles. They're trying to deconstruct what's thrown at them. They're trying to make sense of the world. They're trying to be curious, which we know is a precursor to learning. And it's a natural thing that they're born with that we squash once they enter school and we start to sort of like say, no, you don't ask too many questions, right? And so that's one thing, but then also the movement component. So the questions, the movement component, and then the autonomy. We know that kids and adults need a lot of autonomy over their learning, right? Like that's sort of the key to learn, the curiosity and the autonomy. And when you put them in this environment where you let them question things, when you let them sort of like guide and by what they're interested in, and you let them conduct their own and set their pace, and they're going to be engaged, you know, because kids want to learn and they want a challenge. The problem is that when we put them into this very structured environments and we suddenly remove all the choices and they have no choice over the subjects, over the pace, over the way they're assessed, no wonder they lose interest in school. No wonder they start misbehaving. No wonder they're bored and they say they hate school, right? It's because we've removed the natural elements of learning. So I'm just very happy that you have your kids in a different kind of environment.
Hey guys, just to let you know, my Carnivore Cure book is back in stock. For 9 months, it was out of print and used prices were up to $300. Make sure to get your copy today that has over 200 colored tables and graphics and over 400 pages of meaty goodness. We have a limited supply, so get your copy today on Amazon.com. And if you can leave a review, I'd be super grateful. What's interesting is, it makes sense once you're outside of that box of, yeah, it makes sense that they're not in a typical school where we have boys, especially. And I always wondered, our little one is a lot more excited and needs to have a lot more energy released from him. Mm-hmm. I wonder if in public school, if he would have been diagnosed with some type of illness that, mm-hmm. oh, he can't sit still, he can't pay attention. And then it just makes me wonder, where did this come from that we think classes and schools and kids need to be educated this way? Because it's sort of universal mm-hmm. in the way that this school program or function is happening.
Yeah. So I dug into all the history when I was asking questions about why things were the way they are. And it turns out that, you know, education used to be the job of parents and churches and tutors 200 years ago. But then that started to change in a region of Germany called Prussia. So they had just been defeated by Napoleon's army, and government leaders decided, okay, you know, in order for this not to happen again, we need to take charge of educating the population, the youth, in order to have a strong fighting force, right? And so it was the first time that they decided to group together children into these buildings and put a squadron leader at the front and teach them all the same things. And the goal was to prepare a generation for the military to be one of the strongest fighting forces. And so this became the basis of our modern education system. The whole idea of specialized buildings, mandated attendance, extended school year, you know, being in school from the beginning of the day until 3, 4 p.m., moving kids from grade to grade. And so this model worked, right? Like Prussia built one of the strongest fighting forces in the world. And so it spread across the globe like wildfire. And the United States around the 1960s, after World War II and, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, kind of revealed the importance of a nation's manufacturing capacity. And so the US led this next movement, and the theme was standardization and efficiency. You would group kids by age, you would put them all through the same curriculum, you would ring bells every 45 minutes, you would have like that teacher, you would assess them, and any kid that did not quite fit the mold was labeled as defective. So as you can see, it worked pretty much like a factory. So the whole point of education shifted from training kids for the military to training kids to work at factories and to be managers of corporations and the assembly line. And so it may have made sense back then, right? But then fast forward to 2023, we no longer need factory workers. We no longer need to train people, for, you know, the youth for the military. There's a special place for that, right? And yet we continue to do things this way. What we need now is a generation of kids that can think for themselves, that can be creative and think about creative ways to solve society's biggest pressing problems. We need problem solvers. We need people that can adjust to constant change and figure things out and question things and challenge the status quo. But that's not the kind of people that we're churning out with the education system. And people ask why, and I wish I had a great answer for this, but the reality is that it's an entity that has been in place for so many years, and it has so many different stakeholders, and there's so many forces and people in the top that, you know, it's very influenced by politics, and there's just a lot going on that it makes it very difficult for any individual to make things move in a different direction. And so a lot of people talk about trying to, you know, and work really hard to try to reform and to try to, you know, add stuff. And we've added a little bit of technology over here. The results are pretty much the same. You know, the people that are making up the curriculums are the same people that are making up the tests. And so we're teaching for the tests from curriculums that are outdated. And it's become sort of like a game that I talk about in the book, you know, the game of school. And the game of school does not transfer to the game of life. And we need to be teaching kids a different game, right? We need to be teaching them how to find their strengths, how to succeed in this kind of world, not how to succeed in school. Because again, that's every day that's less and less relevant to the world that we live in. And so that's why a lot of my work focuses on let's find alternatives outside the system or build a system in parallel, because I don't think the system will go anywhere, like the traditional school system, unfortunately, at least not while we're alive, because parents to drop their kids off somewhere. So it does serve as a babysitting center. Sure. And somewhere that's, you know, quote unquote safe, because of course that's been changing in the US in the past years, unfortunately. But I think that for a lot of reasons, it's not going to go anywhere. However, a lot of parents like you during COVID, they started to see what was going on, because for the first time you had like front seat to your kids' education and it didn't look good. And of course, you know, when you parentheses of people were trying their best, you know, one day to another, we're trying to figure out what to do. And they just grabbed the brick and mortar schools and they put them online. That's not real online learning. You know, people were just trying to problem solve at the moment. But real online learning is when you design something with a digital audience in mind, and it's not like putting kids in front of a computer for 8 hours. Like if that wasn't working in the real world and they weren't paying attention or absorbing information with a real teacher and classmates, it's not going to work online. So just small parenthesis for that. But what I'm trying to say is it's a system that was designed many years ago for a very different purpose. And yet we continue to use it nowadays.
The tinfoil hat of me, if I were to say it that way, would be now it just works so well. Because if you think about if we use this for manufacturing and efficiencies, now it works so well to churn people to have the same narrative, right? So just don't ever question the police. Don't ever question authority. Just do as I say, then go into corporates and work the 9 to 5, put your heads down, then shop at Costco and be the same suburban mom and dad and family. Mm-hmm. But you see the ramifications because in our wellness space, I see the obesity where people are so tired of the jobs they work and they're unhappy. So then they come home to veg out in front of the TV and that's their entertainment, but they're really in an unhappy job and they're gaining weight because they're eating the bad foods. And then those foods itself makes them have brain fog. And it's just this vicious cycle. And then they'll use alcohol to numb themselves to go to bed. And I just see if you maybe start with the diet, then you can see, okay, now I'm having less brain fog, certain things, maybe I'm not happy at my job. And so It's not just the paycheck we have to share, because what's the point of having a paycheck if we live a life that we're miserable? So who cares that it's affording us that? And I know some people will say this is an international podcast, but people will say it's because you live in a good country. And so that's not fair to say. So I get that. But I just think we have to drive for more than what we are, because you see the decline in overall health and wellness, I guess, in our populations, especially in countries that have the funds.
Absolutely. So you touched upon a few things there. It's incredible that, again, we teach things that you're like, when in the world are my kids going to use this? And they would ask me and I'm like, I'm 31 and I still have not used this in my entire life. And so, but then there are all these other things like wellness. And I mean like actual, proper wellness. We don't teach that in school really, right? Or, financial literacy. Like how is it that we do not focus on the things that are practical, the things that we know that kids would learn? Well, that's just not part of the curriculum. And so that's one thing. And then the other thing that I realized was, there's so many adults that are depressed, that have, taking all these sorts of medications because they're unhappy, because they don't know what their purpose in life is. They don't know how they ended up in these jobs that they hate. They're in debt from university, from these degrees that really mean much less nowadays than they used to. They were promised that, if they worked hard all these years and they paid all this money, that they're going to land a job that makes them happy, and that did not. And there's so many people in this boat. And it's like, how did we end up here? And if you think about it, it all starts from school, the kind of things that we've talked about that we're teaching, those implicit messages that we continue reinforcing in school, but also schools focus so much on remediating kids' weaknesses instead of doubling down on their strengths. We know that kids are so different and they have different aptitudes and different interests, and sometimes they're not reflected in the academic environment or in this, again, one-size-fits-all curriculums that we use in most schools. I know that there are exceptions, and I'm talking about, like, I'm generalizing here, right? What would happen if we focused, and there are some school systems around the world that do this. For example, in Finland, kids from a very young age, parents are noticing what their aptitudes are, whether it's music, sports, cooking, whatever it is, right? And then from an early age, they kind of said, okay, let's make, it could be tennis, whatever. Let's make this person really, this kid really good at this. Obviously, the kid has to agree. It has to be something that they're interested in, and they can switch in the way, as they go. But I think that that's a much better way to prepare kids for the real world. And I think that it would, I don't know if it would completely solve the problem that I mentioned, but I feel like we would have happier adults, right? That know what they're good at, that wake up every day and want to do things. And, this whole notion of having to work from 8 to 5 or having to go to school from 7 to 3, 7 to 4, it's like, we know that, and COVID has showed us, a lot of people went remote, that there's a lot of wasted time and downtime when you do that, right? What would happen? And in education, particularly, we're getting there with technology. If we could condense all the academic learning into a few hours a day so that kids could have the rest of the day to engage in other things. And like I said, just play, be kids, play sports, do whatever it is that they want to do that's not being stuck in school, quote unquote, learning. And the same for adults. Like we know about, you know, this like 4-hour weeks or, you know, if you're able to structure your days in certain ways, where you're way more productive working a few hours a day versus sitting on a job at this desk for so many hours. But I feel like it's, again, like attitudes and behaviors and just habits that we've picked up from school that we just carry on into adulthood and into the workspace.
Right. And it's, we also don't question it again. So it's, it's normal to work 8 to 5 and it's normal, quote unquote, this normalcy. You know, what is it about play and games that support learning, especially at a young age?
Yeah. So again, the way that kids, and you know, kids are born with this desire, they're hardwired to learn. And how do they do that? Through play, through exploration. I have a 10-month-old baby at home and I love to watch him. He's like not afraid of anything and he does not get tired. He does not talk yet. So he's not asking questions yet. However, you see him, you know, grabbing something and he's so confused and he's like, I don't, you know, he doesn't understand. And he'll stay there playing, trying to figure out why doesn't this open? Why is this making it? And he just entertains himself for hours trying to understand and play and, you know, he's exploring. And it's so beautiful to watch because a lot is going on and there's, you know, I'm not there and I try to, you know, I have playtime with him where I'm like, you know, explaining a few words and going over a few things, but he also has his independent playtime where I do not intervene because I believe that that's where, you know, that's very necessary, where he's like doing this make-believe play and sort of like coming up with his own things and nobody's directing him, right? Nobody's judging him. Nobody, he's like doing his thing. And so there's this beautiful and thing, and there's a lot of research behind play and it shows how, you know, it evokes that feeling of curiosity, of wonder, of aha, that is a precursor to learning. A lot of that is lost once you, again, put learning into this very confined ways. And we, again, structure it by subject, by this, and we put bells and we put grades and we remove all that play component. Not only that, but, you know, in schools, in like, if you look at our parents and their childhood and how they grew up, a lot of them had plenty of time to go outside and play and nobody was supervising them. And they were just, you know, there was no technology back then. So you could make an argument that, you know, there was a lot of games and, you know, in person. Nowadays, maybe that looks a bit more online and there are games online, but a part of the things that we do in the startup that I'm part of, everything is game-based and it's simulations and it's online, but it evokes a very similar feeling where kids feel in control, feels are sort of the kids are directing their own learning and it feels like play to them. And that's the whole point of learning. Learning should feel like play so that you continue doing it for the rest of your life. When learning is forced and when it comes with, you know, when you're trying to make them do something and there's no rationale behind it and they can't see the connection between, oh, you're going to need this in 10 years, maybe. Or you're going to, you know, this is for your future. They can't make that connection. They don't have the capacity to make that long-term commitment. So they don't want to invest. But when it's play, when it's not, when they, you know, they're not scared of being judged, when they're just doing their thing, like that's where I would argue that genuine learning happens. And you can't measure that, right? You can't put a grade to that. You can't know, but you know that they're learning just by, you know, their reactions, the kind of questions that they're asking, the fact that they're not giving up, that they're confused. And I talk about this in my book, The Power of Confusion, of, oh, wait, this doesn't fit my existing mental model, but I'm this, you know, the fact that I'm confused, you know, incentivizes me, motivates me to want to understand that if you don't put a grade to it and if you don't penalize it, right? And so there's just so many different components and aspects of play that are very important for the learning process. And I think that we kind of lose that as we grow up, right? As we grow up, it's sort of everything feels like a chore. Like there's, we've learned that, you know, reading a book, a lot of people associate it with school and with mandatory and with, you know, reading levels and this and that. And it's like, again, we're removing the joy out of an activity that is supposed to be pleasurable, right? And so a lot of my work and a lot of my attitude towards life and all, it's like, how do we restore this fun element and this play element into our daily lives again? Because I think that the more we can emulate kids, the happier we can be.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting. I'm going to try to touch upon a few points. So I was reading a book recently that was talking about all of that extrinsic versus intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about how lots of companies these days will say, if I give you more money, or I'll give you a bonus if you finish something. So initially they'll get a lot of people to get stuff done, but the long-term effect is that they will do less. Whenever there's an extrinsic factor attached to it, their motivation goes down. So I can see that with kids in the grade. So my older son loves math. And then I was just concerned with, so they sometimes use some of the online tools and some of them use it grades or percentages of completion. And I'm always hesitant of, I hope he doesn't lose that love for math. So I totally see that. Another interesting factor is you were talking about boredom, and we had parents that were around us and we had a day where we were working, so our kids were going to be bored at home. And I had many days like that when I was young, but we literally got judgment from our family friends and said, you're going to let your kids just stay at home bored? That's so strange. But the benefit we have seen, and so I felt that mom guilt of I'm working and I should be letting them have all this Disneyland or whatever this stuff is. But I've noticed over time that when they got bored, they figure out ways to have fun. So they started making weapons with sticks, right? And going out. And like you said, if it didn't fit, they figured out other ways to make their gun look like a gun or something. And I noticed that's where now I saw it really in action, where that's where creativity happens. And they started imagining things and playing games that I could never imagine as two young boys, but they started playing in these areas that they just imagine on their own. And I just saw how much more creative they were. And when we busy our children with all these activities and homework, I just imagine, like, how much are we having our children lose that creativity at such a young age by just filling them with those things?
Absolutely.
And so with that, you know, what are ways that we can also support learning with our children?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to connect that to the two points that you said. One of the biggest things, and I love that topic of motivation, because I feel like parents and teachers have sort of, you know, default noticed, you know, the rewards. And we believe, and there's a reason for this, right? That, you know, a reward that is a behavior that is rewarded or punished is more or less likely to occur again, right? And so this is true in the short term, right? So if your kid does something and you punish them, they're likely to learn, okay, I'm not going to do this again because I'm going to get punished. However, what research shows is that that's only true if it's a logical consequence. If it's a punishment, like the kind, you know, like you ran in the hallway, so you're not going to have recess. That's completely disconnected. Kids don't understand how running in the hallway is connected to recess. And therefore, because they're not able to make this connection, they're not going to learn from that. And they're likely to do that again. If your kid is running down the stairs and you're like, oh, that's not safe, you can't do that, a logical consequence is to make them go all the way up again and walk downstairs. See, that's connected, and it has to happen right away. You cannot wait a few minutes because then again, that connection won't happen. And so there's a very big difference between punishments and logical consequences, but I'm talking about like the carrots and sticks, which is the most popular way in schools, in companies, and at home. You know, my mom had that like sticker chart. If you do, you know, your homework and laundry and this and that, like you get the stickers. And at first, you know, that first week, it was like, oh, magic, it all worked. After a while, I got bored of it and it stops working. And that's what the research shows, that this kind of extrinsic rewards, you know, like the prices or the sticker charts or, you know, the punishments, they stop working after a while. So for example, what you were saying, kids that use this apps that, you know, whether it's the percentage or maybe it's like the little character. And if you pass this level, you go to the piggy store and then this and that, it works at the beginning. But then when the math gets really hard, those extrinsic incentives are not enough to push kids or motivate kids to keep going. And so what ends up happening is a lot of teachers grow super frustrated because their class goes chaos after those incentives stop working. And so something that I tried in my classroom that I think is very much applicable to parents and to everyone was, I was like, no, I'm not going to fall into this trap. We're not going to have, you know, all this like rewards tied to behavior or to achievement. We're going to have celebrations, but just for the sake of celebrating that we're together, that we're learning. And so we did have a lot of fun. So don't get me wrong. However, the things that I focused on were the things that were intrinsically motivating the students, because that's the kind of thing that last over time. And they reinforce the message of, you're learning this for the sake of it, or because of the joy of learning, which is the kind of message that I wanted to teach my kids. I didn't want to teach them you're doing this or you're learning this so that you get a reward, because I think that's a messed up way of, you know, teaching kids to learn. And so the kind of things that you can do is you give kids autonomy and choices. And it sounds very, you know, like, wait, simple, but it works like magic. When you tell kids, when you make kids, you know, feel empowered that they have choices, and it can be something as simple as, you know, what do you want to wear to go to the restaurant? You want to wear that Spider-Man outfit? It's kind of ridiculous, but sure, you know, you just give them the choice. It's not a big deal, right? But it's for them, the fact that you're giving them a choice, they're less likely to misbehave later because they feel like they have a saying over something. If it's about reading, you get them, you know, where do you want to read, here or there, or what book do you want to read? So giving them choices, giving them autonomy, giving them responsibilities and a voice and a saying in conversations and in decisions. So you can give them, in my classroom, I gave them classroom jobs that they took very seriously. And even the quote unquote troublemakers, they felt like part of the community. They felt like what their jobs, you know, helped, you know, fulfill a purpose in the classroom. And so they felt important, and that helped them misbehave, you know, behave way better because they had something relevant to them. And so that tied with involving them in decisions, I think is huge, right? Like that's such a powerful way to create intrinsic motivation. Like when you treat them like adults, kids don't like to be treated like, oh, and looked down to or this and that. No, they want to be, you know, treated equal, right? And this doesn't mean you need to be permissive about everything or not put boundaries. Not at all. Kids need boundaries. However, involving them in decisions and making them feel like they have a voice in things, that works wonders. So that's, you know, one thing that helps not only for behavior things, but for learning in general. You know, starting with the things that they're already curious about and dedicating some time to that, super, super important, and it works wonders. The second part, which was the part about letting them be bored and sort of giving them space. If you look at the schedule of kids nowadays, and I talked a little bit about this earlier, some kids are busier than CEOs. I mean, I look at that and I am terrified. Why? Because again, there's a lot of data that shows that those creative breakthroughs happen when you're able to step back and sort of observe from a distance, when you let your ideas linger. Like I'm a writer and I learned this the hard way, right? Because in school, I would teach writing the way that we probably learned how to write, which now I've had to unlearn in order to be able to relearn how to write for the modern world. But a lot of it was, I thought that I had to start from zero and open a blank page and sit there until I could come up with ideas. It turns out, no, I write from abundance, right? I'm walking around, weeks can go by where I'm just taking notes in my phone about different things that I'm interested in. I read about topics that have nothing to do with education that I'm curious about. And I'll just write notes and notes and notes. And then after a few weeks, like, it will just come to me in the weirdest time when I'm driving, when I'm doing this, and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to write. And then I sit down and boom, it just comes out. It doesn't come out perfect, but it's a great starting point. And why? Because I've learned to not force it. And I've learned that I need to step back and let it go and think about something else and read about something else and just let it marinate in order for that creative idea to click in. And I think that that's true for learning. And so if we kind of gave kids, that's why I love this idea of, and this is something every parent can do, letting them engage in a project at home that just lasts, you know, weeks or however long they want it to last, right? And you provide with the space and the resources and you help them however way that they, you don't conduct it, you let them conduct it, but you're there to make sure that they're sort of on track and you can assist them in any way. But just let them spend as much time as they want in that and come back to it and not force them to like finish or stick to it. No, just kind of like let them be. And you'll notice that over time, they'll come back with new ideas, they'll come back with new things. And it's because it's very different from what happens in school, right? Where again, they're interrupted every 45 minutes. They're told when to stop, even if they want to continue or when they need to like tune in and be curious. That's not how it works. And so something that I tell parents a lot, it's like, how can you, you know, support your children at home? You let them engage in these kinds of things. You pay a lot of attention to what your kids are naturally drawn to. And again, we're so used to looking at the things that schools invite us to look at, like the grades and the academic stuff and this and that. And if that happens to be your child's strength, great, amazing. But oftentimes kids have different things. And so not being, you know, even if it's something that you don't necessarily understand where they would take this, support that and be what I call the perfect enabler, right? Like if you see that your kid has a serious and productive interest in something, do anything you can to support that. That is the common thing that the most successful people out there have. And the people that sort of, you know, carved their own path and did things differently and then ended up, you know, achieving these incredible things or doing things. It's like, if you look and I've I've done a lot of research on this, in the background of this people, because I want to know, you know, what is it that they have in common? And the one thing that I've noticed they all have in common is that they had parents that supported them all the way through. Since they were little, they would hear, you know, okay, you want to try that? That's kind of crazy, but let's go for it. And as long as they are dedicating a lot of time to it and working hard in it, then you support that, right? And you give them confidence that they can take that in any direction they want. And so that's one thing. The other thing is paying a lot of attention to who you're surrounding your kids to. And so you were mentioning earlier that your kids are in this different school where they're surrounded by kids that are probably questioning things and asking a lot. That's how you raise independent-minded thinkers. I think that schools are raising kids that are very conventionally minded because, again, they tell you this is the way to do things. This is what we all believe. This is the right way to, you know, this is the path to succeed. And so everything's kind of like laid out for you. And if you can't pull your kids out of school, which is the reality for many people, then at least find outside of school groups of kids that will challenge your kids' ways of thinking. And so it can be online, because sometimes, you know, you can't find that in your neighborhood or around you, but the online world is huge and there are amazing programs out there. And I mentioned some in the book where kids can interact with kids from all over the world that challenge their assumptions, that, you know, bring in cultural differences, that enhance their communication skills. And it's just, it's incredible. You mentioned earlier that your kids are in school too, that have mixed age groups, which is something that I fully support and I talk a lot about, because when in the world do you only interact with people your age, right? In school, right? In the real world, you're interacting with people that are older than you, with people that are younger than you, with people in your community. And I feel like the earlier that we expose kids to this kind of social environments, the better they're going to know how to navigate this and how to interact with these kinds of people, right? We know that regardless of what you end up doing in the real world, you need to be able to work in teams. Even if you have a solopreneur or whatever, you have to work with other people. And knowing how to do that, it requires a lot of practice, just like knowing how to fail productively, knowing how to figure things out, knowing how to work collaboratively, you know, requires practice. And so giving kids the practice in that. And then lastly, you know, finding outside of school as well, if you can't pull your kids out of school and put them in this more alternative programs that do all this stuff, finding some sort of real, like a way for them to engage in real problems, but in simulations or in games or in things like that, but where they feel like they have stakes in it and where they have, again, to make decisions and wrestle with the outcome of their choices and understand trade-offs. And, you know, because again, these are skills that they're not learning in school and that are super important as adults. And then last one that I'm going to mention is, this one's really hard, even for me as a parent, but we all want to make sure our kids feel safe and we want to protect them and we don't want to see them suffer and we want for them to be happy. However, sometimes we overplay our hand. And so by trying to make them happy and this and that, we deprive them from hardship and from failure and from things that may hurt their feelings or, you know, and the problem with that is that the world is filled with adversity and there will get to a point where your kids will not be under your wing and they will face adversity. It will come their way, you know. Loved ones are going to pass away. They're probably going to have a breakup or a mean boss or, you know, failed business. I don't know. Like they're going to come, but it's going to happen. And so the earlier that we prepare them for this, the better. If we sort of try to intervene and solve their problems and, you know, try to shine them away from all this, we're actually hindering them. And that's what I, you know, believe that turns into fragile adults, right? And I believe that kids are actually anti-fragile. They're born anti-fragile. And it is our responsibility to kind of cultivate that anti-fragility. And so how do we do that? By not intervening when they're doing dangerous things carefully, right? And again, it's not about like stepping out and disconnecting. Obviously not. The kids need a lot of guidance from their parents and they need to know that we're there emotionally and to support them. But saying, you know, you can actually do this. Like you're confused, you're frustrated, you can't figure it out. I believe in you. You can do this. I'm going to be here, but I'm not going to solve this for you. Or, you know, I'm going to help you come with the tools or the language to solve this problem by yourself. Or, you know, go ahead and try that, you know, challenging thing in the playground. Or yes, try out for that soccer team. And you may not make it, but go ahead and try for it. And then if you don't make it, I'll be there for you. And we'll handle together your frustration. And we'll think about what you can do next time. But this is so important. And again, I don't necessarily think that we're doing a good job teaching this in school. I think it comes from home.
Yeah, I think those are such good, important points. Two examples I could just talk about or ramble on right now is that one, our kids were part of a jujitsu tournament And so they got awards. One of them, there wasn't enough participants in their group. And so they were able to get we called it a participant award, but it was because there just wasn't enough. So regardless, even if he lost all the rounds, he would get an award. And so we decided as a family, and it was hard for me. So I knew how happy my kid was getting that. And he lost one of the rounds. And I knew that my husband was ready to take it away. And so I even squabbled a little bit with my husband of, well, at least he tried. And we made the hard decision of taking it away, and there were tears, and it broke my heart as a mom. But I think the next hour of us explaining why almost everything in life will never be participatory awards, and you'll have to deal with hardship. And that, from that moment, I saw the benefit, because then my kid was like, I want to win next time. Mm-hmm. And so now we're doing extra hours and prepping for the next jujitsu match. And he was also humbled to see, okay, maybe in my class, my immediate class, I've been winning because I'm a bigger kid, but in the real world, I lost. And so I think that was very humbling. As a mom, it broke my heart. But yep. I think the bigger picture of him seeing, mm-hmm. okay, I need more grit. I need more resiliency. I need to practice harder. I'm not the best in the game at all. And I don't deserve that medal, because I probably wouldn't have received it had there been many more participants. Mm-hmm. And while that whole thing was very hard for us, I saw the beauty in having him understand, and now seeing how he's more readily wanting to go to practice and get ready so that he can get the award next time if it was deserved.
I love that.
It wasn't easy though. And I think one way that I've also just seen why it's so important where parents have to let their kids fail, which has been very hard for me as like a coddling mom in a sense, is that I was reading this boundaries book, and it was talking about a lot of the adult parents with adult children where the kid is still living at their home, that they're kind of a quote unquote deadbeat and they're not doing stuff. And so the 50-year-old or 60-year-old mom is frustrated, but a lot of it was their own doing. Mm-hmm. And that was a big wake up call of mine, where sometimes my kids will say, Mom, can you just tie my shoe? Mom, can you just grab this? Can you just make sure that my gear is ready from jujitsu? Reading that book really triggered me to realize, oh, I kind of do those things when I'm thinking, oh, it's just easier or faster right. if I do it. But I realize I'm debilitating my children.
Absolutely. And that's what I love the Montessori approach. I don't have one particular like methodology or approach or method that I say like this is the right way to educate kids. No, I think that they're wonderful things for many different approaches. Something I love about Montessori is that since kids are very little, you start to give them this responsibilities and you start to let them do things themselves. And sometimes, you know, it requires a lot of patience on the parent's side, because again, everything takes three times as longer. You need to sort of like, and you, yeah, there's a lot of quote unquote waste of time. No, it's not waste of time though, because once they become good at it, then they're so independent, right? And I think that one of the biggest problems in school is that we don't teach kids to be independent, and then they turn 18 and we let them in the wild and we're like, be independent. And they're like, well, what do I do, right? Of course, because we haven't let them make choices, like real choices, or make decisions and then wrestle with the outcomes of those decisions, or just practice being independent. Because like you said, with the best intentions, I believe we're trying to help them, right? But it's about stopping and saying, okay, I want to help them. Wait, is this actually helping them? Or is this just making this process faster? Okay, no, let me pause. And again, it's super hard, but I think that, I think that there's a way to do it in a loving way, in the way that they don't feel like, oh, my parents don't want to help. No, it's like you're trying to teach them so that they're better off later in life.
Yeah. So what do you think are some ways that we can raise successful kids? As you mentioned, most people will say, well, I don't have the ability to send my kids to a special school where we have to pay because we just don't have that ability. What are other ways that then maybe we can start having successful children, even if they're plugged into a public school system?
Yeah. So we've talked about a few things already, but some that we haven't talked about are, and again, this are just simple things that you can start doing at home that foster the kind of attitude and the kind of skills that over time become really useful. So for example, the whole questioning component, making, and this is hard again as a parent when you have, you know, your child starts talking and they're like, but why? And we get frustrated at some point, or we're tired, we come back from work and we're just like, because I said so, or stop asking questions, or, you know, it's normal. Like, we've all done it. I've done it as a teacher. Like, however, like we said, that is kids' attempt to think for themselves. And so instead of training them out of that, and you already know that once they start traditional school, that's happening there. So let, you know, open it up at home for them to ask as many questions and push them to ask questions. And here's the thing, you don't have to have the answers. And I think that this is something that, again, we've been conditioned to believe throughout life, that saying, I don't know, is a bad thing. And it means, you know, it's a weakness, or it means that you've failed. No, saying I don't know, it just means that you haven't figured it out yet. And it's an opportunity to then figure it out. And so the faster that parents can sort of teach kids or model this, and kids are like, oh, you know, just say, I actually don't know. But you know what, you go ahead and figure that out and then come back and tell me, I can't wait to learn. So you can teach me that. Wow. Like, that's, you know, you are empowering. They're like, wait, my mom and my dad don't know everything, and that's okay. And I actually get to teach them something, even though I'm a kid and they're adults. And that kind of, again, subliminal message that you're sending is so strong and so powerful. And it's something that they're not learning in school. And so you kind of foster the things that it all starts with. And I think that my book can help with that. Starting to reflect on the things that don't make sense anymore, or reflecting on your own learning experience when you were growing up and the things that were sort of like pushed on to you and that you blindly sort of like trusted and you automatically do as an adult, questioning like which ones make sense and which ones don't make sense and what do you want to teach your kid, right? Like, and so the moment you realize that yourself, then you can start making changes at home. So one is the questioning one, and the not being afraid to say, I don't know. And it's a very simple one. And I talk about in my book of a strategy of a game you can do. It's very simple, but at dinner, you can have like a weekly myth busting discussion where you have your kids sort of pick a side that they would normally not pick, right? So let's say that your kids believe that one of your kids believes that, you know, they're aliens and that the aliens are true. And the other one's like, no way. Well, you have them switch. It's like, okay, you're going to, for this dinner, you're going to actually make an argument for why aliens do exist. And so suddenly what you're doing is that kids have to put themselves on the other side. They realize that there's two sides to the story, and that you can, you know, you can back up both sides, and that their way is not the only way. And it's a way for them to sort of detect their biases, which I think is huge to raise independent minded kids, right? And sort of like playing devil's advocate is really good for that. And it's just like a simple thing that you can try. The other thing is, you know, in school, we focus so much on, and I think that parents do this too, like perseverance and teaching kids to persevere and the importance of grit. And I think that that is very important, but we fail to talk about the importance of quitting. Mm-hmm. And I think that in order to raise successful kids, they need to know, you know, when to persevere, but then when, you know, they're persevering in the wrong direction, then it's time to quit, right? And when to say no to things that really are not adding anything to them, because they may be closing doors to other things that are way more suitable to them, right? And so what I've noticed with kids is that a lot of them don't want to try new things because they're scared that they're going to have to stick to them even if they don't like them. And that's because, again, we've reinforced this message of, you know, quitters are losers, or you don't quit. Like, that's not when in reality, well, first of all, you know, research shows that people have over a dozen jobs in their lifetime, right? And so instead of being like, no, you can't quit. And the first time that I learned about this was from a friend, an HBS professor called Deepak Malhotra. And he was giving a commencement speech where he said, you know, quit early, quit often, not because it's hard, but because it sucks. And there's so much power to that, because you tell kids, you know, you're not quitting because it's too challenging, or, you know, or because you think you're not able to. No, you're quitting because maybe it's not right for you. And there's a way to do that. You can have like sort of the way that I did it in my classroom. And I'll give you an example, and you can do this with your kids, is I noticed that a lot of my kids did not want to stick to book, like read books, because they were like, oh, if I grab this book, I'm going to have to read it till the end. And sometimes, you know, we kind of believe that, oh, we start a book, we need to finish the book. But no, sometimes the book is just not a good fit. Sometimes it gets boring. Sometimes you get the lesson or the message in the first half of it, so you don't have to read the other half. Or sometimes, you know, your interests change. And so I actually think it's totally fine. Like, I've became an avid reader the moment I realized it's totally okay to start and abandon a book. I start and abandon books all the time. And that's made me read a lot more, right? So I try to challenge that in my classroom. And all my students, we came up with a list of reasons why, or principles why they could abandon a book. And so we came up with that list. And, you know, sometimes it was like, oh, the conflict is not really interesting. Or I've read books that already talk about this, or it got boring, or, you know, it doesn't catch my interest, a bunch of different reasons. And what ended up happening was that my students started to read a lot more. And once they found that book that actually clicked, they would read it all the way to completion. And some kids were finishing books when they had never finished a book in their life. And it was sort of fostering that love for reading. And I was like, wow. You know, just by making that small shift of it's okay to quit. And I think that you can do something similar with your kids. If, you know, they're trying a new sport, you can together come up with a list of principles why they would potentially quit or, you know, stop going to that. And another big part of that is sort of the reflection component, right? You can ask them questions after, like your kid goes to basketball once and they're like, I don't want to do this anymore. It's like, okay, let's kind of talk about your experience. You know, like what was something that felt really good? What was something that was really challenging, but that you think that if you kept coming back, you would get really good at? Or, you know, what do you think it took Michael Jordan to get really good at this sport? And so that kind of conversation and those kind of questions help them realize that, oh, maybe I should keep coming and should keep trying. But then if I realize that I get to come back to these principles that we came up with at the beginning, and I can let it go. And that sort of ties up to my next topic that I also talk in the book in the section of raising successful kids, which is this concept of range and specific knowledge, right? So range is a concept that I learned from David Epstein in his book Range, where he talks about how the Nobel Prize winners or the best, you know, players in sports and business people, like usually they are so good at what they do, at their craft, because previously they've been exposed to a range of different things and they tried different things in different fields that sort of added to their skill set to make them really good then at that one thing that then they got, you know, they're very specific on. And so it's this whole notion of starting up by giving them a range of different things and letting them try a range of different sports, even if they want to become, you know, soccer players, helping them see that, you know, some of the soccer players were actually, you know, playing other sports first, and that helped them develop skills that then made them excellent soccer players. And so that kind of thing. So exposing them to a diverse content diet and cultures and people and sports. And then you start to see, you know, what are the things that they can quit because, you know, it's not quite the right match? And what are the things that they should double down on? And then that's their specific knowledge, right? That those things that feel like play to them, but look like work to others, right? And I feel like that's kind of the key to success and to living a happy life, when you find what feels like play to you and work to others, and you're able to monetize that. And it starts at a young age, right? And it starts by, you know, parents have a huge role here, observing and kind of guiding them. And again, this is not something that kids are going to learn in school. So yeah, so those are some of the things that come to mind. And if anything comes to mind that you read that you want me to expand on, I'll be happy to do that.
What about the risk of not changing all of this learning, right? So everything you say makes so much sense to me, but I'm kind of already following the footsteps of what you're recommending, and I'm learning new things. I think about jujitsu and how they're going to even do acting now. And I just wonder, you know, we have to keep broadening their horizons of figuring out, like you said, that passion, and then deciding if this still makes sense to double down on. And I don't know if for one of my children, the jujitsu is. So, you know, that, so I'm learning from you. But what's the risk of not changing our course in our children's learning? And even in, you know, even for us, if let's say there was a long period I didn't like reading because I think it was that mentality of, I need to finish a book, so I better make sure the book is really good. Or it was attributed to school, and some of the school classes I didn't like. And so it just had that negative connotation to me. And now I love reading. I'm always reading new material. So what's the risk of not changing?
I can't remember who the quote is from. I think it's Alvin Toffler. Pardon me if I'm mispronouncing his name, but he said that I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but that the smartest people nowadays are not the people that can read and write, but the people that can learn and unlearn. And so this whole idea of unlearning the things that are no longer valuable so that you can make room to learn the things that are super important, that, and again, the whole aspect of questioning things in order to be able to make those changes. When we question things, we innovate. When we don't question things, we're stuck with the status quo. And so in order to answer this question, I first want to touch up on the point that a lot of the things and the pressures that parents have today, we've made it up ourselves, or the school has made it up. Like, for example, this whole notion, and it's crazy because it's driving parents insane, and they're passing this anxiety to their kids who start to believe that then they're not good, there's a problem with them, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. But if you start to ask, you know, who said that, you know, kids need to be reading by first grade? You know, that's sort of like a universal thing. Well, not really. There's some countries like Finland where that doesn't happen. But, you know, in most places, like, it's like this pressure. Oh, by first grade, kids need to be learning how to read. And if they don't, then reading remediation group, like, we talk to the parents have to put them in a support group or tutoring and this and that. Oh my God, if you look at the data, there's no data to support that. And yet there's so much data to support the fact that we all mature at different rates and times, and that some kids are ready to learn by three, some kids are learning to, you know, ready to learn by 12. And the outcome, if you don't force them, is pretty much the same. And so we're forcing kids, we're forcing many kids to learn how to read, to do math, to do writing before they're ready. And as a result, again, most of them, many of them turn in the, you know, with the labels of, you know, the low group and this and that. And so everyone believes that that's true. And many of them grow up to believe that they're not good in reading, that they're not good with numbers, that when in reality, they were just not ready at that moment to being forced with the methods that we use to learn how to read or to learn how to do math or this and that. And so that example just shows, and there are a lot of examples like that. And that, you know, again, I got to be a student and a teacher. So I saw a lot of this going on, and now I'm a parent. So I'm like, I'm not going to let this pressures drive me crazy. My kid is fine. And, you know, the most important thing is that you foster a love for reading. You expose them to literacy-rich environments. You read to them. They see you reading, because we model the kind of behavior that we want our kids to have. So they are always constantly looking at you and your parents to learn things. And so just wanted to touch upon that. And then that sort of makes you realize, okay, a lot of people just continue sending and delegating all of their kids' education to school because they haven't stopped to question anything. And they're like, oh, it worked for me, right? I turned out fine. So, you know, my kids will be fine. But fine is not good enough, right? You know, kids are the inventors and the explorers of our future, right? We know that the system is not serving, and I'm not saying all of them. There's some kids that do benefit, and that is their learning, you know, the way that they learn and the way that they like to be assessed, and it just clicks. And if that's your case, great. But for most kids, that's not the reality. And so what are you risking by just going through the motions and saying, you know, he will be fine or she will be fine, I turned out fine? We, you know, you have one shot, right? You have that period of time. And I have a graph in my book that shows like your kid's life. And then those first 18 years is just one part of their life. So that's sort of the time that you have to influence them, to teach them whatever you want to teach them, to, you know, model the kinds of behaviors. So do you really just want to like say, oh, you know, I'm delegating this whole thing and I'm not doing any changes and whatever happens, happens? We know that those first 18 years set the stage for the rest of their lives as adults, right? Like the decisions that we make, the kind of environment that we put them in, the way that we approach them, that we talk to them, the kind of people we expose them to. And so we do have control over that. And it's baffling to me that some people, I think that people that do this usually don't know. I want to believe that they don't know. I don't want to believe that they know and they're doing this on purpose. But yeah, it's just like, no, this is the time where you have to be extra cautious and paying attention and making all the changes and trying things. And if it doesn't work, you try something else. And if it doesn't work, you try something else, you know, but not giving up, because that is the time that you can do your most important job, which is to be a parent.
I think it's so powerful because I got sick and that's what made me challenge status quo. And then that made me then put my kids outside of status quo. And I think it's so hard, but even from all that I've learned in the last 5 years of being sick and then being in this space, I'll still get comments of, oh, your kid doesn't know how to do X. And then I feel that, ooh, maybe it's because they're not in that traditional model and maybe my kids are going to be left behind. But I have to remember, does it really matter if they don't know X? And it's just this, there's always will be forever this beating of the Joneses. And we just have to be comfortable that if we don't follow the norm, there will be many times where a parent will ask, what grade are you in? And then my kids look at me like, what grade am I in? And I'm like, I don't know. Wait, what? Let's do the math, right? We don't know. And it's not always easy being different and not status quo. But I promise you that there are rewards that are so beneficial. And I'm just saying this because it's so hard to be outside of that status quo, but the benefits that you can reap are so great. And we just always need to have some trailblazers like yourself in doing this book, because that's how we will evoke change and we will challenge status quo to learn that maybe it's not good to have DDT on our lawns or have Coke in our Coca-Cola, right? Yeah. It's people that challenge status quo that bring good change. And so I think your book is so powerful.
Thank you. I just want to say two quick comments on that because what you just said is so powerful. I'm loving this conversation. One, nobody knows your kid better than you. And it sounds like, oh, of course, but people forget this because again, there's so much pressure around you and so much comparison and so much, you know, that comes from school, from other parents, from this. Nobody knows your kid better than you. And there is no better teacher for your kid than you. And so if in your heart, what you're doing, you feel like it's working because you look at your kid and no grade is telling you this or assess. No, it's like you look at your kid, you know if your kid is happy, you know if your kid is learning, you know if your kid wants to continue to learn. Like nobody knows that better than mom and dad. And you don't have to explain it to anybody, right? And so I think it's normal to feel when you're doing something different. And I experienced this as well. Everyone's like, well, what do you mean you're not thinking about preschool? I'm like, my son is 10 months. And they're like, yeah, but you have to, you need to be thinking about this. There's a wait list. And there's a, and I'm like, I'm not putting my son in preschool. Like if you look at kids, in like countries like Finland, they don't start school until they're seven because, and everyone's like, well, they're behind by the time they're seven. No, they're not. They spent 7 years running around, playing, doing what kids are supposed to do. And so it looks different and people criticize that. But again, it goes to show like those people have, like that resembles with what I believe in. And that makes sense to me. So I always say, I don't think there's a right way. I just feel like there's a right way for your family. So you find what you feel fits with your family and your family's needs, and then you stick to that. So that's one thing, but thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I mean, I think your book, I really think graphics are so important, and I'll show it in the intro when I'm doing this, but I think it's so important to learn. It makes sense. Like you have one graphic where it's the teachers in the front and everything is all the little yellow dots are, you know, the arrows are focused just on that one versus when the teacher's in the middle and then it's just messy, but that's how we're all figuring out answers. Because I just think very logically, sometimes we know as adults that not all adults are right. And so if you may happen to have an adult that's the teacher that's teaching your children something that you may not agree on. But I don't think we ever think these things. We think teacher, policeman, doctor, they're always right because they must know something that I don't know. And it, again, took me until I got sick to then challenge status quo. And you realize we're all human. We all make mistakes. And like you said, we will always march to what has made sense for our own families, our own lives. And then we're going to teach it that way. Whether, again, you're a teacher or you're a professor or you're a doctor, you will do what makes sense in your own N equals one. But that doesn't work for everyone.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Diversity of approaches, right? That's what we need to double down on, not the one way to do things.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you really quickly about medication. So a lot of kids, I read this book a while ago called ADHD Nation. And it's highly controversial in terms of how they pushed the medication. I think everyone should read that if they have not read it. But what are your thoughts of so many diagnoses on a child has ADD or ADHD or autism, and that's why they can't sit still. And so therefore they should be getting medicated.
So this is a very controversial topic, like you said, and it's social. It's also a very personal thing, which I haven't talked a lot about because it involves my own personal experience. But I, like many people, got diagnosed with ADHD at a very young age. I was a very active kid. I loved to play. I couldn't stop talking. I was excited about everything under the sun. And so, of course, I did not feel, you know, fit the mold of that student in a traditional classroom. And so early on, I got diagnosed, and my parents, you know, with the best intentions, but they were, you know, those friends that would not quite challenge the status quo and this and that, they did things wonderfully with me. But that was one thing that we often talk about now as adults, like, oh, wow. And so the doctors were like, yep, ADHD. The teachers were like, yep, ADHD. And so I started medication. And that medication, like many people know, would tamper down all the aspects of my personality that I believe make me who I am today and sort of like my strengths. And not only that, and so again, this happened for many, many years, but not only that part and the whole like physiological addiction component that then was really hard for me to stop taking the medicine once I was old enough and had my own judgment. It was like, I don't need this. It was really, really difficult to get off the medicine, like extremely difficult. I was put in doses that made absolutely no sense, but a doctor was telling me so, several doctors were telling me so, of course I believed it, and so on and so forth. But more than that, the whole psychological component. And, you know, the message that I received over and over again growing up was, you're disruptive, you're impulsive, you talk too much. If you don't take this medicine, you won't have friends, your teachers will get mad at me, you'll get in trouble, you'll do crazy things. And that was the message that I got from my parents, from my teachers, and from doctors all my life growing up. And so when I finally decided that I wanted to let go, it was not only hard because of the physiological component, because they're highly addictive, but also because I feared that if I left this, I was not going to be smart. I was not going to have friends. I was going to be different. Which is what I wanted to talk to you earlier about, the fitting in component. And so it was so hard. And it was probably one of the hardest things that I've had to do in my life. And it took a lot of help from people that loved me. And when I finally like overcame it, I was an adult. I was a teacher, and I would start to get in the requests from parents and doctors and the letters for me to sign up. And you know, I get goosebumps talking about this because I would look at these kids and I was like, no. Again, we're putting kids in this environment where they're not being able to do the things that we know that they need in order to develop, and they're just being normal kids. But we have been trained to believe that their behavior is abnormal, when really what's abnormal is the conditions that we're putting them in. And then we think the solution to that is to medicate them. And a lot of them, and again, it's very controversial, so, you know, mind me, but I believe that it's a fabricated disease that we've made up by putting kids in the wrong kind of environment. And again, a lot of people may hear this and may be like, well, no, they're except, and you know, I'm happy to be wrong about this. And I'm not a doctor, so I haven't gone, but I believe that. I believe that. And of course there may be exceptions, but I feel like the amount of kids that are in this medication should not be in that medication. And more parents need to stop and question and say, you know, no. No, you know, even if a doctor's telling me this and a teacher's telling me this, you know your child. So it's a very delicate thing. And it's something that really frustrates me and concerns me. And then, you know, I'm talking about the kids, right? Because of course I know of the use of this drug when kids are in college, et cetera, but you know, they're kind of making a bit more rational decisions because they know what they're getting into kind of when mm-hmm. you're older. But when you're kids, it's literally a decision that's been made for you. Yes. You know, like I think I was 8 or 9, or I can't even remember how old I was, but it's like you kids, that's something that I think it's crazy. And so for parents that are listening to this, and if you've heard this before and you have teachers telling you, I would just invite you to stop and think and question if your kid really has ADHD or if your kid is just a normal kid in an abnormal environment. And if that's the case, then there are alternatives and there are different kinds of schools, and hopefully you can make a different choice for your family.
Well, thank you. I mean, thank you for sharing your story. I know that's not always easy. I think the ADHD Nation totally affirms what you just said too about the fabrication of the illness. Mm-hmm. I think that book shows a lot of the studies, the history of how the medication came about. I think it was a man that wanted to medicate his wife that was unruly, and then it worked. And so then they're like, how do we sell this essentially to other people? And then they started making diagnosis, and then they had it for the boys, and they're like, it works. Like, let's actually, now we want it for the girls. We need to change the definition of the illness. So it just goes into the history of that. And not mm-hmm. to say that we're not wired differently, but I agree with you. I think when we decide to give medications or shots to our young children, it is our duty as parents to make the right decisions, because mm-hmm. our children are blindly trusting us mm-hmm. to do what's in the best favor for them. And so there was a period where I read that book. I was so impassioned by it. And I went into all these Facebook groups with all these moms suffering with children that were diagnosed with this. And you could see them say that their kid was quote unquote normal or well-behaved until the medication's wearing off in the evening. And so then they would give another stimulus of coffee or Mountain Dew. And I just thought, that can't be normal for a child. So then they would sleep with those stimulants. And what if it's the red dye that we're consuming? Because lots of kids' candies have a lot of red dyes and food dyes that have shown to have hyperactivity. And I mean, let alone all this stuff we're talking about, the actual environment affecting us being in a classroom for 8 hours. It's hard even for adults to be in an 8 hour office without getting up and having breaks. I mean, we have mandatory breaks even as an 8 hour shift worker to go on a lunch break and 2 15-minute, if not more. And yet you expect young children to sit there. And then when they don't fit the bill, they're like, we need to medicate you. And none of it ever has the child have a voice in it. It's the parents, the teachers, the counselor, the psychiatrist. And that it breaks my heart because
absolutely
the studies then show that a lot of these children that then become adults have addictive personalities or they use other substances, and you may risk their future well-being unknowingly because you just wanted the child to be a little less unruly when it could just be that that's their nature.
And even I'm very passionate about this topic too. I could talk about it, but also the their self-esteem, right? When you make them believe for so many years, like I'm glad I was able to get out of it and I know my worth and I know like, wow, no, actually like this is what makes me who I am and this is my strength and this is why I'm so passionate about what I do and I love what I do and I wake up every, it's because of the way that I am, right? And so they try to put me into a box, but I'm so glad I was able to get out of that box and realize that a lot of people don't end up doing that. And they also have a lot of self-esteem issues because they believe that they, again, need this pill or that they are a certain way. And it's, again, all these labels. And again, this also spills into the world, you know, why, when you start to question, well, why are people, adults, like grown adults, using this pill recreationally, right? Like in college. And is that also the kind of lifestyle that we have now? Everything's so like, we're kind of in this, what do you call that? The rats that they're in this.
In a vicious cycle?
Yes.
Where you or just like a hamster wheel?
Like, yes, where everything's like so fast. And you know, if you look at Europeans, for example, they enjoy life and they're more, you know, they stop working at this time and they have more vacation and they sleep for 2 hours. I'm generalizing here, but if you look at sort of the American lifestyle, like it's like everything's so fast paced and there's so much competition and everyone's like, that we need something like, you know, the stimulants. People feel like they need this in order to keep up and in order to keep playing this. And so, yeah, it's a whole, but with kids, it's even worse because they're not even making those decisions themselves. So yeah, lots to reconsider and to question here.
So I believe that there's always a reason for people's struggles and troubles, and just that what you go through then becomes your passion and purpose to share. Mm-hmm. Me getting sick, being plant-based for 12 years, and then now sharing the nutrient density of meat. It's become my passion because I was really sick. And I think your whatever you had gone through and now showing that you can thrive and you have this book that makes so much sense in terms of how we can support parents and children. Even if you can't leave the public school system, there's still things you can do. And now you're sharing your gifts that at one point were questioned. And I love that. And it makes your book even that much more powerful. So thank you.
No, thank you so much. I loved this conversation.
Where can people find your book? I found you on Twitter, so I don't know if that's your biggest place, but where can people find you if you have other sites and stuff if you want to share?
Yeah. So I'm very active on Twitter. My handle is AnnaFabrega11. I'm also on Instagram, MsFab_LearningLab. I have a newsletter called Fab Fridays that has been paused for the past few months because of the baby, but I'm coming back to it where I share something every Friday, alternative ways to learn and just lots of questions to reflect on. And then my book, The Learning Game, that again came out 2 weeks ago, is available anywhere online where you buy books, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, ThriftBooks, wherever you buy books online. And you can also find it in your nearest bookstore. So yeah.
And I'll put all of it in the show notes. I think I'm signed up for your newsletter too. And all of the, you put your graphics in the newsletter too, right?
Yeah. So I think it's
really helpful even to just get small dose reminders that maybe what we're doing, even if it's different, is normal. And it's, this is how we can evoke change, especially in our children, which we want our children to be independent so that when I'm 60, I don't have to worry as much about my children thriving in this world.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I think this was such a powerful conversation. I love your book. I love your graphics. And I think it's such a great way to start this conversation. And your cover is so brilliant. My son saw it and he's like, that is such a smart image. And
I love it.
It's thinking outside of the box.
Exactly.
You know, so I love,
that. Oh,
I love
that
it.
Made my day. That made
yeah,
my day.
My 9-year-old loved your book cover. He loved it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Judy.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Anna has so much information that she has gleaned from different authors and her own story and her own research as a teacher and as a student. And she shares all her wisdom with us in this conversation, as well as in her book. I talked a little bit about a graphic that she talked about where the teacher was in the front versus all the students on the bottom, and actually mixed up the colors, but you could see it right here and it makes so much sense. I find that these infographics are so helpful, and I know I could be biased about that, but this book helps you to have tactical ways that you can start supporting children and your loved ones, help improve things in their life so that they are not working in a system that is not working for themselves. I think when we're part of these systems that naturally aren't the way we are wired or that work for us, it shows and manifests with addiction or emotional baggage or certain things that just, there's this dissonance in our lives where, yes, we may be working and making a ton of money, but we're depressed and unhappy and maybe medicating with alcohol or food or drugs. It's these things that we need a challenge to figure out, well, what will make us happy? I was willing to change to a nutritional position, even though I was okay knowing that the average salary was less than half of what I was making. And it ultimately brought me much better happiness and purpose than I ever had before. And maybe that's part of the reason why I no longer struggle with food addiction, because I'm no longer in a job. While it was making me money, I was really miserable in the work that I was doing. It's these things that we have to think about that, well, maybe I don't have a child in school, or maybe this information doesn't apply to me, but it actually does apply to everybody. When we are fixed in this status quo and we don't question narratives, whatever it may be, we will start blindly following things just because a leader or a person or expert has said it. But sometimes they're not right. At the end of the day, we are all humans and our opinions may matter more, or if not the same as someone else. It's just knowing that sometimes we need a question, and that is such an important and integral thing that we need to do in order to thrive in this society. And for my children personally, I want them to do that. If everything in this world becomes chaos, I want my children, by them not going to a traditional school, that they figure out how to make it work and how to survive, whatever that future looks like. And we are choosing to educate our children in a way that they stay curious, that they question everything, so that in case chaos occurs, they will figure it out. And I know that they'll be okay. Okay, guys, make sure to eat a lot of meat, take care of your bodies and your minds and your curiosity for learning, because it's the only place you have to live. I will talk to you later. Bye, guys. Thanks for listening to the Nutrition with Judy podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please make sure to leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app so more listeners like you can find the show. If you want more practitioner care and support, head over to nutritionwithjudy.com/groups so you can get more real talk about carnivore, the environment, and root cause healing. You can also find my content on Nutrition with Judy's YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Make sure to sign up for my weekly newsletter and learn more about in-depth articles with infographics at nutritionwithjudy.com/articles. You can find my 2 books, Carnivore Cure and The Complete Carnivore Diet for Beginners, on carnivorecure.com and amazon.com. At the heart of Nutrition with Judy's practice, our mission lies with a deep, unwavering passion for service and community. We will continue to empower you to have the knowledge and tools to live a life nearly symptom-free, because we firmly believe in healing and wellness for all.